Hello, everybody. It's Tom here today, joined again by the inimitable and erudite James Tunney. And we're sort of picking up where we left off in terms of the relationships which obtain among various terms, myth, scientocracy, and so forth. And but providentially or fortunately, another theme has been taken up in recent discussions here. My most recent interview is with Arthur Dewey, and the relationship between the mythological and the historical character of Christianity arises in that conversation. This is something else which I believe we're going to touch upon today. But in any event, enough for me. Let me turn it over to James. With one caveat that I'm concerned about the audio, so I apologize to my audience for background noise. We're going to try and soldier through nonetheless, and I thank you for your patience with that inconvenience. All said, let me turn it over to you, James.
Thanks, Tom. And I agree that the issues that are emerging in your various discussions touch on issues that are relevant to me. That recurrence is important, exploration, to explore the relationship between these issues. And in particular, you've touched on the issue of the nature of mythology and scientocracy. Or that's the way I would interpret it. I'm getting feedback on that, Thomas. It's just coming back to me. The sound is that. So it's.
Can you hear me now?
I can, yeah. But. Shall I proceed, or do you want to start? Will we start it again?
We can make source of recording. Well, you can no, it's just we can carry on from here.
Okay, Grant. So there's an important connection in relation to the mythology and scientocracy, and in particular, interrelationship between mythology and scientism or science. And there's two ways we have to look at this. The first way is in relation to the relationship between facts or facticity and reality and mythology. And the second one is in relation to the mythology of science and scientism itself. And this is one that's underestimated in relation to the discourse in general, that when we come to science and scientism, there is a great mythology of science which is ignored, most particularly by scientists. And the idea of the mythology of science has been explored by a number of writers. I'd point to Mary Midgley in the United Kingdom as a philosopher who has explored the mythological basis of science. Now, in that context, she's looking at myths in the context of a myth as a false statement or a false assertion, an implied argument, not necessarily at the ancient myth, but that comes into it. So we also have to consider the impact of ancient myths on the context of science and scientism. And we touched on that in relation to Babylon, which is important. So, in relation to the idea of the myth as a false statement about something and a popular meaning of myth, we have a number of myths that are very, very important. And in particular, she focuses on the myth of omnicompetence of science or omniscience of science, the myth of progress, the myth of the social contract, and she argues that these are inherent myths that scientists live by and that we live by in the book, Myths We Live By. So that is important. And we can see this false mythical context applying in most particularly in relation to artificial intelligence. And I argue, and I will be arguing, that most of the debate about artificial intelligence is mythic. It's not about the reality of artificial intelligence. It's about mythic constructions. And there's a very specific reason for that. The specific reason for that is because the purpose of artificial intelligence, the origins of artificial intelligence, are being disguised. The origin in the military industrial complex is not really an attractive proposition in many senses. So as a result, we've had a mythic camouflaging of what artificial intelligence is. And this is very clear when you look at the recurrence of the word magic by scientists when they're talking about artificial intelligence. When we see the memo must have gone out, which says the genie is out of the bottle, because they all repeat this statement, the genie is out of the bottle. Of course, the genie is let out of the bottle by the people who now propose that we have to regulate it, and they want to regulate it. So there's a remarkable hypocrisy there. But this language of the genie being let out of the bottle is a mythic statements, approaches. But as well as these false mythic statements, and John F. Kennedy said that myths are more dangerous than lies because they can have more impact on people. And of course, we have to look back to Nietzsche and Nietzsche's treatment of myth and the Übermensch and the impact of his views on a number of different systems of thought. And then we have the idea of the influence of ancient myth or things which people regard as myth, particularly sacred myth or myths about or foundational myths. And in that context, we have to look at the origins, and we've talked about some of these issues, Francis Bacon in particular. And we look at Francis Bacon as a key player in this. We have a number of myths which are important. We have the Atlantis myth coming in, which is critical for the Atlanticist regime still, the underlying myth of his utopia, his scientific utopia. But also, if we accept, as Blake would have done, that the myths of the West are heavily influenced by the biblical myths, and if we look back at the historians of science, we see that there are certain myths which are critical in explaining the origins of modern science, and particularly Francis Bacon's views. And we've referred to the Tower of Babel and Tower of Babel, which is very, very important. But also the myth of the fall, if you want to call it a myth. Now, this is another issue with a line between history and reference to real historical events, and myths are important. But in relation to the biblical context, the fall was very, very important after the Reformation. And this was a fundamental basis of the theory of knowledge in Europe, and particularly in the British context. And the idea emerged that after the fall, humans had become ignorant, and that ignorance and sin were fundamentally related. So that the scientific endeavor with its instruments was really an effort to recover the Garden of Eden, to return to the Garden of Eden in some way, to recover what had been lost in the fall. And that's pretty much accepted by the historians of science at the time. So the idea of achieving some kind of perfection through knowledge is an idea which permeates the Baconian agenda, which permeates the work of people like Samuel Hartlib and the intelligencers around the Royal Society, the people who build up the networks of scientists across Europe, and in particular in the imperial context. So this idea and this mythic element permeates until today, and until when we hear people talking about artificial intelligence and machines are better than humans, it refers back through that process back to their treatment of the reason why we had to recover the knowledge that was lost after the fall. It's a peculiar feature, of the Protestant Reformation. And of course, that fits into the stories of the Garden of Eden, and in relation to the ideas of plantation, what plantation was, which I've referred to before, and the idea of recovery of the garden. Now, the garden that's going to be recovered is not some natural garden. It's the projection of the scientific methods onto the world. And the last point, just to start off, we can see this attitude, strangely, in modern context, in discussions of artificial intelligence. I'm delighted that people like Yuval Noah Harari are telling us what their views are now quite openly. And it's very interesting if we look at some of the leaders in the context of artificial intelligence, like Ben Goetzel. He did an interview a few months ago, and he said that we're not playing God, we are building God. And this is critical. Now we're seeing, and Elon Musk has said this as well about the people running Google, that there is a divine mission there. And this divine mission has a historical pedigree. And also, it also goes back to, again, to the Babylonian period, again, that trajectory that we talked about in relation to Arthur C. Clarke, which is reflected in other approaches which bring us back there. For example, in John Maynard Keynes writing about Isaac Newton, describes him as the last of the magicians, and he traces his lineage back to Mesopotamia. So this extra ancient myth context is critical. And when we talk about the Abrahamic religions, we have to put in science itself, because if we look at Francis Bacon, if we're taking him as the father of the modern method, his New Atlantis refers back to this period as well to give it pedigree. So some of these myths are alive and well. We can reconcile in our notion of myths. For example, some theorists say that, which I don't agree with, that a myth is something which people understand is not historical and is untrue. I don't agree with that, because I don't believe that people believe that their myths were untrue or not historical in the past. I think this is a modern reflection. But certainly in the context of those two classes, the myths which are false, the claims about the body of science, about scientism, about technology, about progress, the inevitability of progress, and other ideas about where we're going. We see, for example, in the artificial intelligence context, a myth of the promised land. This is radical abundance. It's a statement in a mythic way that we are going to live in an area of radical abundance after this artificial intelligence, while at the same time they're telling us that we have to cut back and we have to reduce our... It doesn't make sense. It doesn't go together. It's a mythic presentation. So there's false myth and there's ancient myths mixed up there, as opposed to looking at the reality of the origins of artificial intelligence. So what I'm saying is that scientocracy is inherently mythical. Most of the futurism is mythical. It's built on myths, and it's claimed to be mythic. So 2001, A Space Odyssey, going back to the Greeks, the future is something that we imagine. It looks technical, it may look plausible, but it's based on a mythic construction of the future. I think I'll leave it at that, an opening statement.
I mean, that's very sweeping and effective as an introduction. As you speak, a few questions occur. One of them is almost academic, as you sort of describe how the myth of the fall plays into the Reformation, Counter-Reformation, early modern theories of science as a grounding for the project of science. And on the one hand, I want to ask you to sort of explicate how there is an implicit rejection of the logic of the myth in that grounding. And what I mean more explicitly is this, that there is a rejection of the notion of man's exile from Eden, and by implication, the justice of God. In other words, there's a resentment at the heart of the original founding of the scientific project. I guess, do you feel that that is the case? And then academically, I'm also reminded of Milton, whose Paradise Lost, I think, was an integral text for many figures in that interval that provides a sort of, now you have to appreciate Milton wrote Paradise Lost, and then there's Paradise Gained, Regained, and so forth, right? Which sort of moves beyond the logic of Paradise Lost. But there's a certain portrayal of Satan within Paradise Lost that I think is consonant within with the many aspects of the scientific project. So to turn it back to you, what do you think about all that? That there's actually an acknowledgement of the myth as having a kind of reality, and then a rejection of what can be derived from that reality in the decision to exile man from the Garden of Eden.
Yes, what I find difficult to understand and suggested by your question is the why the Old Testament and the older texts are more important than the New Testament. And this is the thing that really is not easy to answer in this context. Because it seems that a lot of the mythic construction of the mentality behind empire in Britain was a reference back to the ancient Israelites in a particular time. And I think that particular time brings us back to Babylon and those times. So they seem to be more interested in the Old Testament rather than the New Testament, which is interesting. In that, I think you're right in the implication that it's a resentment, but there's an extra element to it. It doesn't end there. The resentment is a kind of put to the side by the leverage of this new technique of the instruments of science, of the instruments of empire. So that Francis Bacon takes a line out of Daniel, which there's no reading I can do of it, that gives the construction, which he believes leads to a justification or a necessity to exploit circumnavigation of the world. It's just one line out of Daniel, and you kind of say, well, I don't know where he got that from, but it was important. So yeah, you have an effort in construction of fragments of the Old Testament to construct a picture. The resentment then is turned into a fuel to drive this new agenda. So the consequences, in my view, are that they say, well, if we can use this method of knowledge to achieve this state, we can construct this new garden. And in constructing the new garden, we can recover the paradise partially. But it's more than that. And this is how we get to, I think, views of people like Harari and Goethe. It's that if we, going backwards, can recover these things, we can do what Prometheus did and slip into heaven, and then we can take over. I really believe that that's the extra bit that we have to bear in mind. That if we take this, the celebration of Prometheus, and it's a trickster, if you like, but it's not that. It's the audacity of going against the gods. Now, they don't tell you about, you know, that these things don't end well, that the gods don't like, you know, when you're messing about with them. These stories don't lead to success, but they're willing to sacrifice something in order to get as near as they can to a simulacrum of heaven or simulacrum of paradise on the earth that will do them. So implicit in that for me is an exclusion of commitment to certain values with a focus on this goal, and particularly in the material world, to privilege the material world. So yes, there's no question. I think that the resentment is inherent in there, but there is an idea that there can be a a godlike position which is attained by that, and that is worth struggling for. That and this is what's inherent in this effort to recover the Tower of Babylon, to rebuild it, that we find suggested in Arthur C. Clarke. So resentment, but divine ambition as well.
Does that perhaps actually begin to address why the sort of mythos of the Old Testament sees primacy? Because arguably with the New Testament, you have a different vision of value, one which would exclude power as something to be actively sought and exercised. And as a consequence, there's going to be an almost ineradicable tension with the suggestions of the gospel ethically, as, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount or certain other passages where you have an inversion of imperial mores. There's going to be a tension between that kind of ethical vision on the one hand and on the other, the yearning to supplant the order of nature and create essentially a slave society. I think the focus on the Old Testament, to put it more concisely, is it that the Old Testament represents for them, through the notion of the law, exactly the kind of ethical game they want to play. But the overturning of the notion of law and the promulgation of a vision of love and mercy is at odds with this project.
It must be. In my view, and this is a thing that we have to get back to, about the issue of the historicity or the facticity of the life of Jesus, that if you don't accept, for example, which I do, if you don't accept Jesus as a historical figure, strangely, there's more requirements then that you must explain the power of this myth. If you're saying this is a mythic story, you must then explain why it has been so powerful over 2,000 years, which is strange, but that's not what a lot of people do. And we can come back to this. But if you examined it as a in a kind of archetypal way, you would have to say that this is an example of the same myth that George Lucas is talking about the empire and struggle of the hero against the empire, or George Lucas is a reflection of this, and the empire is inherently bad it's the thing to be struggled against. So if you're just building an empire, well, really, then that's not an appealing story to use to galvanize the troops. You know, that really, you know, we're creating this thing that the hero, if you like, or the divine figure is struggling against. So I can't really see how empire allows you to celebrate the New Testament in the exact same way without altering it significantly. And that's why I've talked elsewhere about the rapture and John Nelson Darby, and how that for me fits into it's a corruption for me, which suits imperial needs, and it leads to very strange results. So the older books suit more, and it brings back to a time that this imperial endeavor is very interested in, back to the time of Babylon and back to that era, because they believe that that's the crucial point. And their desire to go back there, as we see in Arthur C. Clarke, as we see in H.G. Wells, that the future, the New World Center will be back there, is a reflection of what Otto Rank talks about in relation to the significance of the naval, or the omphalos, And that if the navel of the world is in Jerusalem or Babylon, well, then that has to be recovered as well as part of the global enterprise. But I can't see that Jesus Christ fits in very well with the imperial story, in whatever way it's worked.
I mean, he is. I think the tragic fashion in which, in the history of Christianity, Jesus becomes appropriated in order to serve imperial interest vis-a-vis.
Yes.
Not simply, it's a complicated story, but as you see, Constantine and the so-called Constantinian Christianity is an appropriation of the gospel to serve imperial interest, as opposed to prophetic Christianity, as it is sometimes been labeled. I don't think we're actually, for a second, I was concerned that we were getting a little afield, but actually we're not, because something else you'd raised as corresponding for the conversation is the significance of Golgotha and its mythic, or the place of the skull where the crucifixion of Jesus is said to have taken place. Perhaps this is an opportunity to relay your thoughts on that matter.
Yes. So if we come to the story of Jesus, we can see there's a very strong effort, particularly in the United States, there has been, which continued on from the biblical interpretations in Germany in the 19th century, the biblical scholarship, the effort to say everything is mythological. This is, you can't accept this as real. This was an effort which corresponded with the rise of scientism, and scientism obviously had to, or saw that it had to replace any idea that there was historical fact in relation to the story of Jesus. So Orientalism, etc., in Germany, was related to this rewriting and the turning into myth of the story of Jesus. Now, so we see this in the life of C.S. Lewis, where, because he's so rational, he can't accept, the Christian story, until being around people that understand history and understand mythology, they convince him that the factual thing happened, although they weren't necessarily, the people around them didn't necessarily believe in a religious sense or spiritual sense. They said, "Well, actually, this happened," and that was a significant event in relation to his acceptance and his turning towards Christianity, or turning back towards Christianity. So there's a very important point here, that the people in Oxford and Cambridge, but they were experts in mythology, so they knew a myth from a historical evidence, and they could distinguish between them. That's why Tolkien, etc., they can't be dismissed in relation to their describing of the significance of the life of Jesus. So personally, and this is a personal opinion, in relation to the critiques of the historicity, the facticity of Jesus' life, I'm very skeptical about the works that I have read, which dismiss that and which argue that it was a fabrication. That's my personal view. I'm not convinced. I'm more convinced by people like Boukman, etc., who argues about the significance of oral testimony and the privileging of oral testimony at that time to explain the transmission of the story of Jesus. But if you do, if you say, well, this is just a story, and it's a fiction. Now, I noticed when you were having a conversation, the term true fiction came up. Now, if you look at the term that C.S. Lewis used, he said true myth, and this is what him and Tolkien used, the idea of a true myth. So what they were saying was that this is something that fits into the mythic paradigm, but it was true in relation to that had happened. And that was the key difference. So that's a very important distinction. It's that the fundamental elements of the story they believe happened. And again, we can add to that the scholarship of the various, accepting the differences, the different emphasis, the privileging of oral testimony. Now, in a legal context, you can tell about how significant oral testimony is. So also testimony of from pictures or the significance of pictures, they're not as significant as the oral testimony and as the word of mouth, the witnessing and the eyewitnessing. And that's why there's been a lot of critique of the scholarship, which seeks to apply modern criminological methods and say, well, eyewitness testimony is not reliable, etc. In certain contexts, eyewitness testimony is reliable and is significant, especially with extraordinary events. It is. So the books which explain about and trace the eyewitness testimony are very, very important. But if you don't accept that, well, then you have to explain why this story is so important. And you can categorize it and compartmentalize, but you have a problem because you cannot point to any other significant story which has had the same impact on millions of lives. You cannot do that. It's impossible. There's no other story which has had direct impact on people's lives in such a cultural thing so consistently and is also capable of reinterpretation. And funnily enough, if we look at the Scientocracy, their big hero is Prometheus. So Ben Goetzel talks about the significance of the Prometheus Project by Weinberg in the 60s, that book. So Prometheus is critical. But there is no, I haven't come across any stories of apparitions of Prometheus. It's absurd that this construction, a literary construction, is equiparated with a real figure. Nobody really claims that, but yet it's extremely powerful. And the minds behind the Scientocracy act as if it is a real figure, which is quite interesting. So the idea that we can dismiss the story of Jesus merely because you don't think it's true, even though there's contrary evidence, is one that is a strange one. And it doesn't accord with the fact that stories like Prometheus are hugely influential without having a core base which has been examined in the way that the Christian story has been examined. In that context, then there's a challenge that each generation comes back and looks at these stories and does something to it or changes it or adds a layer or adapts it or sees something in this. Now, the mode of interpretation that I think we have to consider in this context is again, they came out of a Protestant context, in particularly Jacob Boehme and Swedenborg, and that in relation to their approaches from a mystical perspective of the interpretation of the divine scriptures. So when we come to Swedenborg, the whole basis of his work was of his divine inspirations, locutions, apparitions, which led him to the conclusion that we couldn't accept the Bible literally or solely literally. Now, he didn't mean we dismissed that, but what he said was that there are different levels of meaning in the Bible and that there you have to look at a different level. So, for example, when you're looking at the creation of the earth in 7 days, you relate it to, it could be the seven chakras or the seven whatever. There's different layers of meaning attached to sacred scriptures. And that this is consistent with the Jewish approach, that the literal meaning is the darkest meaning. It's the least revelatory in certain contexts. That's particularly with the older text. So if you look at Jacob Boehme in relation to his approach, and this is the approach which is fundamentally the basis of a lot of the Western magical tradition, is to focus on symbols and signs. So Boehme was talking about the signature of all things. And this was a crucial part of the mindset. So when you approach a a text or a magical text or the world, you had to look at signs. Now, signs, we might say symbols, were the modus of connection to the higher domains, and they were intentionally left there. And again, there is the term signs and wonders in the Bible about that signs would be a mode of communication from the divine. So when we come to 1902 and William Butler Yeats's essay on magic, he's explaining that the symbols are the link between the great memory, the great mind, and the magician. So this focus on symbols, signs, is very, 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 very important. If we approach it in that modus, and then we come to look at this, if you want to call it the story of Jesus, if you want to call it the myth of Jesus, or the life of Jesus as a fairly kind of accurate record, if you want to, whatever way you approach it. Well, then we have to look as well at the signs, and some of the signs are relevant to particular times. For example, the way that the early Christians in Ireland dealt with the story was different than they would have dealt with at a later period. And as you talked about empire, of course, remember when the Normans are coming to Ireland as Catholics, they are displacing a Catholic population because they have an imperial mindset and they're disregarding the Catholic context, which is there. Again, the misuse of Christianity in an imperial context. But when you come to that, the crucial motif, the crucial sign, I suggest, is the sign of the skull. This is critical. So the crucial element that comes through for me in relation to Golgotha is the skull, that there is a significance about the skull. Now, when we then look at the mythological approach to history, to current events, we see that the skull is critical as well for the Scientocracy. So there's a correspondence between the two, that in both cases, people will look at the same symbol and make something different out. I would ask people to consider why, for example, the Skull and Bone Society, we take the example of the Yale Society, why is that so significant for them? Now, again, we don't have to speculate too far, but the skull is a critical symbol for people that are engaged and have been engaged in becoming the Scientocracy. The skull in a contemporary sense is associated with poison, it's associated with dangerous pharmaceuticals, it's associated with piracy. But if we look at it in a mythological sense, in relation to how the historians have told us the skull was used, and and there is connections up to modern secret societies, that the skull was critical for as a representation of the power of empire over the human body and over the people it ruled. That the skull had a magical significance. The control of the skull, control of the head, was the manifestation of power. And this had very peculiar spiritual bases. If we go back to the descriptions from the historians who looked at Babylon again, that in necromancy, the control of the skull is important because they believed that with the skull of the person, they could communicate with their spirit and control their spirit. So the skull was critical in relation to having power over the intelligences, of having been able to foretell the future, of knowing what the future is. This continues in relation to the brazen head of Roger Bacon in the 19th century, the idea of the oracle. But if you had power over the skull, you had magical power. This is manifested as well in the Celtic context. Now, I can't find out or the origin or the etymology of the word brain is a bit unclear, but it strikes me that it's quite close to the word bran. And Bran is a famous skull in the history of Britain and Ireland, going back to the Welsh myths. And Bran's skull is supposedly buried under Tower Hill in London as a magical protection of this is according to the legends, a magical protection of London and this, and that area around the City of London and the Tower of London. This idea of a magical connection between a skull and is a recurrent a myth. Even the when we come to the you know the celebration skull again, the Vikings and the power of drinking out of the skull. This idea was about having power over the skull, and I believe that there is a deep magical superstitious connection between that long history and the fascination with control of the brain that the examination, the desire to put holes in the skull, to put things in the skull, to control the skull today is very much related to this belief that there is a kind of divine control which is given. And my arguments about artificial intelligence and chips, etc., is that it's a part of a control system. In the Christian context, here we have, now, it's interesting if you look at how artists have looked at this. For example, you can see this in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when it comes to getting the electroconvulsive therapy. He describes it, Ken Kesey describes it, as a crown of thorns. And that's a quite apt artistic interpretation, that the effort to control the brain was, you know, a reflection back to the crown of thorns. What artists focus on in these stories is very, very important. When I was thinking about, is there evidence that other artists really focus on this issue of the skull? And you begin to look at the great artists, the great seers, and you say, yes. For example, 1952, an essay by a short story by Philip K. Dick, which is about a savior and how it might work and how there might be resurrection, is called The Skull. It's well worth reading. It's available on the internet. It's a short story, and he focuses on the skull as the key aspect or symbol associated with a savior. So Golgotha, of course, is the place of the skull. Calvary describes the head. It describes a calvarium. In Latin, the head, cranium, etc. Now, what we have to then ask ourselves is that purely an accident? Is this purely an accident in relation to the story? In the whether you accept it as a myth or whether you accept it as real? And we find, I suggest that in all the story of Golgotha, signaled by the focus on Golgotha and the place of the skull, we have a skull symbology, and brain. We find the issues, a preemption of the issues, which now, with the passage of time, are relevant. Of course, the tomb was there as well, and the story of looking for the tomb is another aspect of the history. So General Gordon, for example, who has a mystical approach, he realizes that he imagines that when he's going to look for the tomb of Jesus, and particularly from a Protestant dimension, that he needs to look for something. So there's something in the sign of the skull. So therefore, he located what he imagined was where the body was entombed, in a hill nearby, which looked like a skull. So what he was focusing on was this skull image. Of course, the body escape or the body resurrecting and coming out of the cave is kind of anticipated by Plato's caves. The story of it fits into a prior idea of escaping from a confined, whatever way you want to look at that. Even if we come down to the robbers on the left and the right side. Which I think is quite amazing. If you read McGilchrist's books, The Master and the Emissary and The Matter with Things, we come down to a determinative view of the significance of the left and the right brain and how they approach the world. And funnily enough, I believe that that's anticipated in the robber story. We have one robber which says, "Okay," which can represent the left brain, if you're God, throw yourself down and save yourself and demonstrate to me, or I won't believe you. Whereas the other robber says, after a while, well, I believe, or I have a sense that you're what you say you are, which is quite a remarkable and succinct statement of the two different hemispheres of the brain in some way that symbolizes, if you like, what in a very erudite, complex, scientific way Ian McGilchrist is saying about the difference in relation to the attitude of the centrality of ourselves. There's a couple of other strange features. If you look at Blake, one of the things he was famous for was this a picture of the lottery for the garments. Now, this is very, very, this is again an interesting element. So in Blake's context, this was important. The garment and the Roman soldiers drawing lots for the garment. What I find odd about this, or what I find relevant about this, is an interesting thing. There's a lot of, and this is seems strange, but I suggest it's relevant. There is a fascination in the Scientocracy with insects, and it's difficult to understand why there is this fascination with insects, with insect food. You're going to be eating bugs shortly, Thomas. They're going to be in this radical abundance. You'll have a radical abundance of locusts and fried locusts, etc. You say, well, why is that? Where did that come from? Now, the thing that worries me about this, when the Scientocracy is pushing this insect stuff, is that chitin, or chitin, whatever some people pronounce it, chitin, doesn't sound, chitin is what insects use for their shells, and that's the hard part of the shells, the carapace, etc. It's the structural building blocks. Now, my problem with this is, my concern is that chitin is, if you look at the scientific papers, is a substance they use for building tissue, for tissue engineering, okay? So that's what they're using it now in a contemporary sense. So if you have this substance, this insect shell stuff, you can build certain tissues in the human body, or use it as a structure, as a scaffolding. So I get a bit concerned when I see that there's patents and there's explorations for this chitin stuff, which comes from the, well, I explained the origin in a second. This is very important for them. It's not good for humans. It seems to be indigestible. But if it's floating around in the body of a group which said they want to experiment on humans, well, then I get concerned. And also, Bernal and the people who are working on DNA were studying this chitin, and in crystallography terms, for they've been studying it for about 100 years. This, they've been fascinated with this substance, which makes me concerned, because these are the people that told us that the scientific corporations would rule. Now, what's the relevance of that? The word comes from this garment. In the Greek, it's chiton is what the garment that they are raffling. So what I'm saying is that the garment, of course, in refers to the garment that was put on Jesus, was disposed or raffled about. But the garment in the chiton context is the garment of the human body. It's the way the human body can be re-engineered in a contemporary sense. So what I'm suggesting is that there's a strange prefiguration in some of these words and concepts in the biblical context. The last one, again, I'll elaborate on this a bit fuller sense. There's a lot of debate, and there's a guy in Gutenberg who's written about this, about the nature of the cross, the symbol of the cross, and what the cross was, what the symbol meant. And there's a fair bit of evidence, or a fair bit of belief, that the cross that we see is not representative of the original cross, that it was probably a T-shaped cross, the Tau cross, which is as St. Francis, the Franciscans, I think, use. So that the cross that Christ was crucified on was a Tau cross. That's a matter of debate. But funnily enough, the Tau cross is kind of represented on the intersection on the skull itself. This shape is on every human skull. There is a T-shaped linkage between the cross. And strangely again, in relation to brain science, the proteins that are emerging as the critical proteins in relation to Alzheimer's and in relation to consciousness in particular, are the Tau proteins. Now, the Tau is an anagram they use, but it's strange that the critical proteins they're focusing on in relation to how consciousness works from a physiological perspective in neurophysiology now, in relation in particular to the patents granted and the areas that are investigated in relation to how Alzheimer's cause, are the Tau proteins, which has a link back to ancient Christianity, ancient symbolism of the time. So what all of that, again, I'm going to elaborate. What I'm suggesting that if you think that this is just a story, some old story that fits into some pattern, it's difficult then to judge as the critics do, and explain the significance and the power of the story. Explain why the story is relevant in different generations. The last point: if you look at people who are seen to be identified with the origin of post-structuralism, of political correctness, going back through Foucault, we come to figures like Georges Bataille, and his symbol, the symbol of, what was the symbol of the body that represented his view, the secret society that he set up, the magazine that he set up. And again, he's seen by some to be the father of post-structuralism and a lot of these contemporary things. It was the acephale. It was a headless figure. It was a figure with a head removed. Again, it's the same motif that the control of the head is critical. And his solution is to take the head off the humans review. And this is a fundamental building block of the some of the more advanced critical schools in contemporary. So in summary, what I argue is that one, you can't dismiss the facticity of the story of Jesus very, very easily. If you do, still, you have to try and explain some elements. If you then approach it in the tradition of certain modes of interpretation that have been fundamentally important, Swedenborg is one of the major influential figures in Western culture in the last couple of hundred years, that you see in it what Burma talked about, the signs, which are relevant today, which makes the story curiously relevant. And in that, the relevance of the story, last point, two bits. It focuses on two things. The incarnation has been significant in my view. The incarnation is a critical aspect of what humans are. And that secondly, despite incarnation, if you like, that spiritual consciousness is transcendent and persistent, and that they go together fundamentally. And why incarnation is important, again, we can see it in people like Jacques Ellul and Charbonneau when they go through the work and they say, well, how do we solve this problem of the technological society? Both found that the incarnation in the Christian story was critical. We can add, of course, onto that, Illich talking about life, the notion of life going back to the Christian thing. We talk about Jung, and the idea that individuation goes back to Jesus, and we can talk about Steiner seeing Golgotha as critical. So building on Steiner, I would say, as an extra bit to his mystery of Golgotha, that it's clear to me, taking the modus of interpretation, which is justified in a number of bases, that the skull is the center of contest, and that the Christian story is a celebration not of the skull, but of the spirit and the spirit which it contains, and that the other bits that the Christian emphasizes, they emphasize, for example, is the holy face. I know you're annoyed with the masks and that, but this tradition of the significance of the face is critical in Christianity, which is critical in the Renaissance. It's critical in relation to the expression of the spirit, whereas the skull is static. The spirit is manifested itself in particular ways, like the face, the heart. Is the spiritual consciousness wasn't located in the brain in other cultures. It was located in the heart, in other parts of the body. This is another idea, the idea of the of getting cognition and spirituality together, which is a different view. So I know that's a whistle-stop tour through. In summary, I believe we have to look again at the story and its relevance. And also, last point, sorry for saying the last point, and if you do, and you say, there's nothing to see here, this was all invented, that these stories are not true, you're going further than Machiavelli. You're really going further than Machiavelli. You're going further than the Mafia. The Machiavelli believed that a good leader had to maintain this divine contact. So when you begin to deconstruct and you say, oh, we can pull this out, and you have to, not you personally, Thomas, one has to accept their responsibility for the consequences of that, for the what will happen or what's going to happen when you remove those things. So it's a serious issue about interpretation. It's a serious issue that people have to begin to take responsibility for the views that they're putting forward. Sorry for going on so long, but I thought it was necessary to try and sketch.
No, not at all. I thank you for drawing, connecting all those dots, bringing them together, because you draw that together, weave that tapestry, it has a kind of power which won't be present if you simply indicate things in an ad hoc, hither and thither fashion. I have little to say except for fundamental accord with what you're suggesting. I really think the significance of the incarnate is deserving of emphasis, minimally as a point of reconnecting this conversation to the questions of AI and the virtual. Because what those modalities are encouraging is precisely a displacement from our own body. It's taking us out of our own head, if you will, right? As the locus of who and what we are. It's incredibly decentering. I'm reading right now a text by someone whom I respected because of some argumentations that he's made in other quarters, but who here is arguing that virtual reality has the same sort of ontological weight as our ordinary reality. And roughly the argument goes that given an adequately sophisticated technological basis, if you're in a virtual reality, you're not going to be able to tell. It's going to be indistinguishable from the real world. And so, if that's the case, then the virtual world must be just as good as the real world. So, I mean, that's the gist of his argument. And I bring it up because I think it is a token of where we have arrived culturally that could actually be persuasive to individuals. The assertion is that the indiscernibility of the difference between the counterfeit and the original is an adequate basis for the acceptance of the counterfeit. And for that to hold, you have to be taken out, I would contend, of your own body and your own concrete experience, which strikes me as a violence, as a violence whose significance is difficult to exaggerate. So if we return to the question of the relationship between the historicity and or facticity of these narratives and their mythological character, the importance of working these concepts and their meanings out, I believe now is hopefully thrown into a sharper light. Because if it really is just all illusion and all a dream, and there is no basis or ground for commitment, then what is left? And I don't like the answer to that question.
Yeah, on my view, I think I mentioned it before, I believe that we are essentially spiritual creatures made of light, if you like, and that there is an interesting idea in the medieval context in particular, or going back to the early church fathers, that Satan is the ape of God. Now, not and the ape here is imitator. So that what Satan seeks to do is to imitate the divine project. So that's why they can look the same. Remember, Kazantzakis says that the doors to heaven and hell are adjacent and identical, you know, which is a frightening thing, and that is very true. But if incarnation is critical, which it is, I don't have any doubt, and I think that that value in Christianity is on its own. The significance of that. I mean, we can see it in relation to Krishna. We can see it in the Indian context as well, but it's particularly relevant in relation to the Christian story and its contribution, or Christianity, if you accept as true. But if we begin to flesh out literally, the implications, if it's correct that this is significant and it's transcendent significance, there's other ways that I can apply. Now, I don't know if she said this. I don't know if I imagined this, but Kate Crawford wrote a book called The Atlas of AI, which is quite good, in the sense that it's a critique of AI. It's a similar view to mine, so I'd like it in that sense. But she's basically saying a similar thing to I am, that if you look at the, which she doesn't concentrate on this argument, but in one of the chapters, that AI, of course, is a product of the military-industrial complex. And she may use the word incarnation there. And what I got a sense of is that if you want to make a proper argument about AI, the argument has to be incarnated. By that, one could mean in a epistemological sense that we have to locate the phenomenon in its proper origin. That if we're talking about AI, we have to see where it came from, how it came into being. So there's a kind of a way of seeing that can come on from incarnation, as opposed to just repeating that as being important. We have to make it important. So I argue that if we look at AI and where it's come from, it's absolutely clear that its primary purpose is to be a control system for humans. And that its inevitable consequence of the network is we become assimilated into the network. And this is what, well, people have told us this as well. It's crystal clear. But that comes from an incarnated argument. In that sense, we look at where it came from, because the myth of AI is, it's a myth. It's just arrived. This is a classic mythic story that Otto Rank talked about, that the, like Moses in a basket, like something just coming from nowhere. This is a classic myth of divine origins, that they come in very peculiar way. This is what we're asked to believe about artificial intelligence. We're asked to believe now that they've just realized that artificial intelligence is dangerous. Although in 1968, they made 2001 A Space Odyssey. You know, sorry, David, we have to turn off the, you know, because you're not reliable anymore. So in the 60s, they knew it was dangerous. And now these guys have been working on it. I've only discovered that's dangerous. It doesn't make sense. So in relation to the, so what I suggest as well is, if this analysis is correct, if there is some deeper truth embedded in it, it will also point towards intellectual solutions or intellectual approaches that are relevant. If Jack Ellul and Charbonneau and other people are saying incarnation is critical, we have to look at this again after the, as an antidote to the problem, we should take that important, even if Charbonneau is not disposed towards the Christianity. He understands that that's a critical element of Christian culture. We could argue as well, and I think there is, we must consider about whether there was an inherent cycle intended or calculated about Christianity. That by the time the good news was spread around the world, by that time, you know, it's also written, or the parables are often in terms of an agricultural society. By the time the gospel is spread around the world to all the nations, that we're at a turning point, like 70 generations, like 70 years and 10 generations, or say 30 years around there, that actually there's a lifetime of has come true in a wider sense. And at that stage, humans would be faced with a choice. Now, this idea is not, this idea is what Arthur C. Clarke uses, a number of science fiction writers use, that there's a, once you reach a certain point of evolution, there's a choice to be made and something kicks in. I think there's a similar thing in the Christian sense. At that stage, where we're moving from, where we're moving towards a post-agricultural society, that the older Christian stories don't seem as relevant because people don't live on the farm anymore. They don't understand what a field is anymore. They don't know where their food comes from. So these things don't speak in the same way. Maybe that is written, maybe that's inscribed in the process, that at that stage, the issue, the central issue that becomes relevant is this issue of the control of the mind. And it's not only about control of your mind in this context. I believe that the attempt is to control the eternal soul, that it's a much deeper thing. And the last point, you're talking about the counterfeit and reality. The technosphere is the thing I've talked about for a while. It's not my idea, but it's quite interesting that you two open up in the sphere in Las Vegas with a kind of, an amazing technological perspective for the crowd that can make believe they're in some environment, that they're not, where they can sing their songs like Zoo Station, part of the trajectory. And people love this. People are willing to sacrifice the reality for the illusion. We're moving into this. We're at the point where we have to make a choice as well between whether we accept the counterfeit, whether we accept the promise there, or whether we accept or re-examine reality and reapproach our position in nature, our position in the human way that has evolved, and those fundamental concepts that Jung and Illich and all those were talking about.
It really, the issue of agency of decision is utterly central. For one thing, if you come back to the question, and how does that agency show up or incarnate with reference to the deployment of so-called artificial intelligence? You know, and there's all the scary things about people, you know, putting chips in their brain and so forth. But before we get to that stuff, we can just look at basic, relatively fundamental behavioral decisions, how we relate to these devices and so forth. This is, to me, what's insidious about language generation software like ChatGPT, where people will say, oh, well, it makes certain things more convenient. But what you're doing is you're giving the organ of your voice over to a program, and there's going to be a dialectical relationship between your voice and that program, which will infect your own thoughts and your own ways of speaking, so that even your own utterances become subsumed into the logic and the grammar of a program, which itself is inert, which itself is bereft of actual sentience. And the kind of passivity which arises as a consequence of that cooperation is extremely dangerous, which speaks exactly to your point of control. And it shows up in other sort of like minor ways too, you know, people with their cards using tap pay and so forth, right? It seems innocuous. And some of it is innocuous, but all these little things build up to a surrender of your actual presence in the world. And they're incredibly infantilizing, and also sort of conduce to an insult to your dignity as a being. So the decision is not to participate in those technologies and the kind of engineering and behavioral cueing, which are, I believe, more or less essential to them. Control, decision, and there's a third point which eludes me and may return, but it also brings to mind the question, and you brought him up, I think, one way or the other in all our conversations, right? But the question of the techno rebel, Alvin Toffler, and this isn't exactly fit into what we've said so far, but maybe this is a chance for you to elaborate upon your position vis-a-vis Alvin Toffler's suggestions.
Yeah, he was kind of anticipating that, and he'd seen this. I think if we go back to the 60s, the counterculture and Theodore Roszak was defined in terms of its opposition to technocracy, and people forget about that. That's what the counterculture was in his framing of the issue. And he coined the term. A friend of Jeffrey Mishlove, we've talked about him. So they were aware of these issues in the 60s. They were very aware of the of this division that was happening. And here, and Dreyfus and other people began to understand the limitations of AI, the decontext, the problem of context. Context is critical. And then we had, of course, Norbert Wiener, who was a critical player who understands the dangers of cybernetics in the hands of gadget worshippers. So these people, like you can't say that Wiener was a Luddite. You know, he clearly wasn't. He understood what it was, but he believed that what was happening was that it was the sorcerer's apprentice, the monkey paw, that sorcery was taken over. That there was this deep psychic thing that he hadn't really anticipated, that deep love of magic that this technology gave a power to. If we could add to that, that really this is where the this is where the technology came from this ancient history of magic. This is where it came from. This is where all the pedigree of all the these type of technical things come from. Also, there's a question about art there. Joyce, Stephen Dedalus, the role of artists is something that we have to look at some other time in relation to their role and their the consequences of re-examination of myth, or the consequences of Nietzsche's contribution, both to the Nazis and to the Bolsheviks, unintentional or not. This, the point being about responsibility. But anyway, the rebel, the techno-rebel was a middle category. There wasn't a Luddite, realized that there was good things about technology, that you had to use it, but they weren't embracing it. They didn't love gadgets. They loved humans. They believed that humans should be the masters and not the servants. They weren't left brain. They were more right brains, to use in McGilchrist's thing, or they had a more balanced perspective. So the consequence of that techno-rebel for me is that one of the things that we have to do is to advocate, from my perspective, the starting point of all my work recently has been that we've had a failure of spiritual evolution. The problem is that a lot of people don't believe they have spiritual consciousness. They don't believe that this stuff is real. They don't believe that spiritual experience is real. One person I would cite as a counter to that is Federico Faggin, who contributed a lot to the growth of the consumer micro, the chip and gates, silicon gates technology. So he's a very influential technical person. But then he had a mystical experiences. So he explores consciousness. So he's capable of living in both worlds, of being amphibious. Robert Bigelow is another person who's, you know, interested in space exploration, but very interested in spiritual context. So what I'm saying is that one strategy that the techno-rebel should adopt is to engage in what Charles Lilly talked about, elite defection, to begin to persuade people who are in the technocratic camps that they're simply wrong, and that also that it is a spiritual universe. Now that can only be done by the quality of argumentation. It's not done by presenting a lot of dogma and saying, there, read that. It doesn't work like that. The reality of spiritual consciousness comes into this. The reality of meaning, the reality of the search for meaning, the significance for meaning. These things have to be brought into the agenda. So one of the strategies of the techno-rebels will be to be au fait with the technology, au fait with the arguments, so they're not presenting arguments which are not located in the state of the art, that they understand that, but they also can explain what's wrong with it, or why it doesn't work, or what the limitations are. Because Prometheus is looking at things beforehand, ex ante, and we're not getting the ex post bit. This is the problem in the Promethean story, and we have Epitemus is the other figure, the brother that's left out. But the problem with the Promethean story is we have all risk at the start, all ex ante thinking beforehand, but we don't have the consequences. So what I'm absolutely certain about is that if this is another point which is critical about intellectual responsibility. I believe that the language of a lot of people in the emerging Scientocracy about humans being apes that need to be reprogrammed, etc., is the typical language you get before genocide. If you look at the history of genocide and the prefiguring things, you get this bestialization of people. It's a very, very dangerous era or time in social relations when you get this talking about groups of people in terms of beasts and animals. It usually prefigures a genocidal kind of movement. If we take this reduction of people to animals as consistent with these people across, they constantly say we're ape. And I include in that people like Terence McKenna, who I think has to be examined more critically. When people, they like when people say take drugs and you'll be okay. But he said things that for me that don't indicate a deep faith in humanity. In fact, he was He believed as well that we were only precursors to something else, which where machines were very, very important. But what will happen, and I will increasingly say to people in this domain, is that when the next genocide comes, as it will do, there will be billions this time, that really, if we put in this genocidal talk with the misanthropy and hatred of humans and this post-humanist language that sees humans as a problem, it can only lead to the death of billions. It can only, that can be the only result. If you read the history of genocide, we see this prefigure thing and we see this dangerous reaction. So I would say to people as well that they make these flippant, casual arguments, descriptions of the human being that reject their dignity, that now they have to take consequences. Now you say, well, I don't believe in the afterlife. I don't believe in this. I personally do believe it. I believe there is a karmic consequence. But whether in their lifetime or in the life after they're dead, their words, analysis, are increasingly having consequences. And mea culpa, in the sense, I am responsible, as opposed to I am guilty or something like that, or I'm to blame. I think people have to take responsibility for right words in the terms of what Buddha said. And some of these people are going to realize, some of the academics at the moment are going to realize that they're being played by this system, that they will regret. I have no doubt that some of them are going to seriously regret the game that they've been sucked into. They don't realize how they have been used as useful idiots, despite all their great academic qualifications, to promulgate messages that support a particular ideology. And it's very, very dangerous. So I'm increasingly actually reverting to an idea in my disposition, my sense, that the universe does have a justice inscribed in it. But the consequence of that, the consequence of free will, is you have to take responsibility for your decisions. And that now that we have the opportunity to make bold statements that millions of people can listen to, that really these things have profound effects. And this misanthropy that's consistent with the scientism, the empire of scientism, combined with the imperial disposition, combined with the desire of the Malthusian desire, which is in this, and Mary Midgley criticized Dawkins. She believed that he was a kind of Thatcherite, that there was a myth of competition being the central aspect of evolution. Whereas, of course, if you look at Kropotkin and other people, they emphasize cooperation as a key element. So the techno-rebel has to persuade as well elite defection, people that are really involved in this environment, to change their perspective, not to criticize people from the side. I mean, that's what the robber on the cross is about. It's about people changing their position. It doesn't need years of study in order to qualify to get the grace of whatever it is you believe in. That really, it's about a change of heart. Which is another part of the body that's critical. So the techno rebel has to adopt different strategies. It won't happen in organizations. I'm seeing a kind of knee jerk reaction of people now that are realizing that we're in a great era of difficulty, and they're suggesting all kinds of ridiculous stuff. I'm seeing a resurgence of people talking about in genuinely classical anti-Semitic ways, for example, which I have no time for. Really, you have to build on the degree, the positive things of the degree of whatever you want to call it, rational enlightenment that we have. Look forward, look at new systems, be original, be individual, avoid being captured in organizations, anticipate what they anticipate, look at things from their mind, and persuade people. We have to persuade people about the reality of spiritual consciousness and the reality of the disaster that we're facing, and their role in it as well.
Absolutely. I was hesitating because there's a siren, which you may be able to hear approaching. I don't know. I just want to build very quickly on what you're saying about the importance of language and choice of words. Hold on. All right, there was an ambulance, and I had to wait for it to go by.
Well, that was a John Cage moment. You know, John Cage's sense of music.
Right, this importance of language and how, for example, you can look at the antinatalist position, which is an extreme position, but which has been persuasive to discourage people from having children in their own lives in a very broad way. And I think that this is an example of how the decision to talk about human beings as a problem, the decision to talk about children as an issue or a burden, has created a grave cultural harm and really diminished the potential of certain people's lives. Of course, I don't mean that everyone needs to have children. It's obviously a very personal decision. But nonetheless, the whole atmosphere has been affected by this sort of language that discourages people from relating to that specific sort of set of human yearnings. That's just one example, though I think it is not a trivial one. So I just wanted to add that in there. It connects also to how we choose to relate to each other, that we exist in a relationship with each other that hopefully will give rise to more life. The problem with virtuality is that it's incredibly sterile. Quite literally sterile. If we move into that domain, then the potential for future life is simply eclipsed, negated, and so on. And it really is intimately connected to how we choose to close the world in our language. So I guess I'm just building on your point, I hope, by way of supplementation.
Yeah,
I might
just a
add
little.
also, it's interesting, unrelatedly to that, but well, not to, the myth of Icarus and Daedalus. There's a detail in that myth, which I think is often excluded, but which is interesting, is that Daedalus used to make automata, or little robots, essentially. And people would go, and he was a very wealthy, apparently, person because they prized his automata that were so lifelike as to be sort of disarming. It's just an interesting detail that fits into that particular myth. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that in that particular myth as it pertains to the you alluded to Stephen Dedalus and Joyce, but then there's that backwards allusion to Icarus and Daedalus.
Well, this is, as I explored in the Plantation of Automatons, this long fascination with the automatic figure, and that is critical in relation to Descartes, and he sees the figure as automatic. And it comes down to this is part of the critique that Ian McGilchrist talked about, the left brain. The left brain becomes blind to certain things, and associated with that is a cultural imposition. Associated with people that may be more disposed towards symbolic thinking or technology, that they begin to devalue the humanness. Now, there was a point as you were talking. There was just one little point I thought just kind of relevant. Think about Mary Midgley and Richard Dawkins. There was a controversy, a little controversy about Richard Dawkins in Ireland a few years ago when he. There was a tweet. He was asked about, I think it was a context of a pregnant woman, and what about a pregnant woman that knows she's going or was told she's going to have a baby with Down syndrome? And he said, his tweet, well, of course, it would be immoral to have a child in that context, you know. So he was asked by, you know, so this is the great reviewer of evidence. He was asked by an Irish interviewer. He says, well, how many Down syndrome children do you know? You know, because this interviewer had a child with Down syndrome. He didn't know any, you know. So the question that arises without getting into the issues there is, if artificial intelligence is a guarantee of the increase in human intelligence, why doesn't that protect people that, you know, or give life to people who will have mental defects? If they're so certain that this stuff will be able to cure deficiencies in human intelligence, why doesn't, by that logic, it apply to people that they say shouldn't exist because they're mentally deficient? It won't, there'll be no connection between them, because the reality is that artificial intelligence has one goal, and that is to control us. That is the objective. All the other things they're selling are merely sales pitches that we fall for all the time. It's the mega bribe that Mumford talked about. And the other point about this, associated with this anti-humanism, is this obsession with living in something that looks like a laboratory. It's quite amazing if you look at the pictures now and the, you know, the most expensive kitchens, and they look increasingly like a laboratory. It's as if we're moving into this, well, we are moving into imprisonment. The expression that I would use to describe this, what's happening to us, a word that I've used in my most recent book is immuramentalization, that we are being immured to be put into a wall or surrounded by a wall. So the vision of the future, Orwell talked about, you know, the boot stamping on the face. It won't be like that. It'll be more like a cask of Amontillado, Edgar Allan Poe, where the character is lured by his desire for to drink Amontillado, and he is entombed behind a wall. This is an idea that he also talked about being inhumed. It was a word that Edgar Allan Poe used. Edgar Allan Poe had a strong sense of this as something, some danger in human behavior, I believe, from his concept of the imp of the perverse. And I think that's what's going to happen to us, that we are consistent with all the things you've met, you know, the masks, the isolation, the logic of the behavioralist, separate people, you know, develop a great fear about being in social contact with other humans, with all this constant stuff about sexual abuse, and, you know, all this idea about problematizing any interaction between people. Because in the Christian story, touch is very important. Just normal human touch and healing touch, it's critical. But this is becoming problematized everything, you know, so you're better off staying at home, isolated. And all this process is to immure you in the black chamber, in the black box. The black box is the essential idea in a lot of espionage, in a lot of intelligence gathering. The black chamber, you're opening the letters, inputs and outputs, the same logic in relation to see what goes into Tom's head, see what comes out, and we can guess what's going in there. We are looking at our mobile phone, and we're walking into the black chamber itself. And this is what Edgar Allan Poe's kind of, I think there's an undercurrent anticipation of this. So, and that's intended to be, if they can do it, because some of these people are more spiritual than they let on. If they can control us, our consciousness longer, they will do. So, this process is happening in relation to the media, in relation to public health, in relation to the processes developing the World Health Organization, in relation to digital currency. It's very, very close. It's a lot closer than people understand. The digital currency, you know, the ID systems to use any of this stuff, it's getting very, very close. The ID, the ID, they're going to control that. And it will be, and it immortalization of humanity. All the processes are pointing to that. So we have to kind of at least understand that that's what's happening, if this is what we're consenting to day by day and all our little consents.
Well, I think perhaps this is the point at which to leave it, in part because my battery's about to die. I don't have an outlet next to the machine, right? See, there, you can't escape concrete mechanical realities, you know. But
You have a fine wall there beside you, speaking about walls.
but thank you as always. And we can maybe come back and explore the black box as a notion in itself, because that's also very important for AI and so-called neural nets and this claim that, oh, well, we don't know really what's happening. There's a black box. I actually think that's false. It's kind of an equivocation. But we can leave that for another time. But I think we'll leave it there. Did you have anything else you want to add before we sign off?
No, as always, thanks for the opportunity and the conversation. I enjoyed it as always, and I look forward to more exploration and good luck with your other interviews. I think it's nice to have a range of different perspectives so people can see the different emphasis and make up their own mind in relation to what accords with their own perspective. And so good luck with that.
Thank you, James. You have a good day, evening, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye for now.